From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young from WRTI on the Temple University campus here in Philadelphia. It's Here and Now.
Don't let anyone tell you that our country is weak. We're not. Don't let anyone tell you we don't have what it takes. We do. And most of all, don't believe anyone who says, I alone can fix it.
Hillary Clinton throwing Donald Trump's words from last week back at him in her speech last night, accepting her party's nomination. Today, we spoke with people as they headed into Hillary Clinton's rally right around the corner from us on the Temple University campus.
It's awesome. I love Hillary, the Clintons. I started with Bill's campaign back in the 80s, and I'm happy to be working on Hillary's campaign. She broke the glass ceiling. It's a monumental day, and I'm excited, and I can't wait. She's going to win, and we're going to have a woman, Madam President.
I'm just pumped up. I'm just filled with so much joy and excitement. I've been watching the conventions basically all week, staying up till 1 or 2 a.m. to see all the coverage. It's been so exciting. I just wanted to be part of this historic moment. I mean, it's in my city, and especially after being so pumped up by the convention during the past few days, I just feel like I had to be here in person and experience it myself.
It's so monumental to be here with my mom, who raised me as a feminist, and to be here with my daughter, who I'm raising as a feminist. It's just, I can't even put it into words. It's the most wonderful thing. I've been crying all week. It's just awesome.
Always a feminist.
You were. I cried when she accepted the nomination.
I never thought I'd see this in my lifetime, so it's really great.
I'm super nervous, but this is probably the best thing I'm going to do all weekend.
Yeah, like, I'm just happy that there's going to be a woman president and that she's a Democrat and she's awesome.
Pearl and Sasha Miller before that, Cecily and Ann Kellogg, Betsy Elijah and Larry Wiegand-Jackson, Lori Wiegand-Jackson, heading into Hillary Clinton's rally today. Donald Trump also weighed in on Clinton's speech this morning in a statement. He called Clinton's speech an insulting collection of cliches and recycled rhetoric. As usual, the only ones not throwing shade, our Friday roundtable singers.
Here and now, 2016.
They are always so cheery. Joining us, Greg Moore, former editor of the Denver Post. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, welcome to you as well.
Hello, Robin.
And let's get right to it. Last night, were you surprised, Ron, by there seemed to be almost a party role reversal in the conventions? Patriotism and optimism from the Democrats, but also shouts of USA flags waving, doom and gloom from Republicans. And by the way, did Democrats risk overdoing that because of the anti-war Bernie supporters they needed to woo?
Well, the anti-war Bernie supporters were part of the reason that you saw that great display of patriotism. Only part. Don't want to overemphasize that. But those enormous flags that people were waving that looked like those big flags they use at car dealerships to attract attention, those had something to do with wanting to keep the cameras focused on what the campaign organizers wanted focused on, and not on the efforts of some of the Sanders, not all the Sanders, but some of the Sanders delegates, to bring forward their anti-war positions. They were chanting no more war. They were chanting angrily at General John Allen, who was one of the speakers. And they really wanted to bring forward the part of the Democratic Party that has long had a definite component of anti-war sentiment, back to the Vietnam War, particularly in the 1960s and the famous history. But that was alive on the floor last night, maybe not as audible to the television audience as it was to the people in the arena, but the organizers wanted to make sure that didn't steal the show. So that's why the big flags, and to some degree, that's why the super patriotic programming.
Yeah, well, and Greg, just overall, how did you think it went last night? Did Hillary Clinton in particular do what she needed to do?
Yeah, I think she did what she needed to do. I just thought that convention really displayed the diversity of America. It looked like the America that, you know, certainly I'm familiar with. And it was, a real different view from what the Republicans put on in Cleveland. But I thought she stuck to the issues. I think she painted an optimistic picture of America. And she also, I think, tried to draw a great contrast between her experience and her ability and readiness to lead versus Donald Trump, who she, you know, belittled as someone who could be easily provoked by a tweet and maybe provoke a nuclear war. That's basically right. What she tried to do.
Right. That's what she said. But did she overcome the perception, the narrative? That seems to be one of the buzzwords this week, the narrative of the week, which is that somehow all these people who know her, and it's astonishing how many people had personal testimony about her, that somehow they know a different Hillary Clinton that the electorate knows, that, you know, much of the electorate doesn't trust her, that she can sometimes come across colder in person mm-hmm. than she to a crowd than she is personally. Ron, do you think that she overcame that? Because I thought it was so interesting. There was this beautiful video prior to her speaking. She's so warm, you know, so one-on-one. And then when she comes out to speak publicly, it's different.
At one point, she said herself that in terms of public service, she's always been more comfortable with the service than the public, and she is not great at projecting her personal qualities when she is in a totally public situation, such as giving a speech. So you heard criticism today of the tone of her speech, that it was perhaps a little too harsh. There may be some sexism kind of around the edges of that mm-hmm. criticism,
yeah.
but that it was too strong, that she was too strident. And we will hear that as the campaign goes on. And sometimes in her speech, she hit another note where it sounded more like stern but loving mother kind of thing, a more of a certainly feminine but at the same time very strong leadership kind of quality that came across in the video, but I don't think has come across very well in Clinton's past campaigns or in much of her public role. That has not been conveyed very well.
Well, and by the way, I know the tweets are flying about nobody ever asks about, you know, whether a man is stern or whether, you know, and we understand that. But again, it's this, you know, this issue of perception, what the voters think. And she did address
Robin,
that. She said, oops, go ahead. Go ahead, Greg.
Now, Robin, one thing I think is important here is that, you know, Hillary has some self-inflicted wounds where, you know, she's prone to secrecy and, you know, she's overly defensive and she's, you know, quick to sort of invoke conspiracies when things go awry. And I thought that one of the things that was really good about this convention was showing that this is a woman who's had a long history of being involved in making things better for women and children and trying to deal with some of the persistent social issues that plague this country that can be easily overshadowed by the controversies of the moment. And yeah. that, I thought, was a very effective thing that humanized her in a way that even people who've known her in public life for 25 or 30 years went, oh, yeah, you know what? I forgot about that. And
right.
I thought that was pretty effective.
Let's listen to her talking about how she knows that she is, to some people, kind of a policy wonk.
So it's true. I sweat the details of policy, whether we're talking about the exact level of lead in the drinking water in Flint, Michigan, the number of mental health facilities in Iowa, or the cost of your prescription drugs. Because it's not just a detail if it's your kid, if it's your family. It's a big deal. And it should be a big deal to your president, too.
It has been astonishing. Again, to your point, Greg, you know, when you were reminded of how many stations of the cross there were along the way for Hillary Clinton, she has done so much in her career. But also, I want to just touch on the different voices that came to sort of be her Greek chorus last night. And one of the most memorable, Kaiser Khan. This is the father of the Muslim American soldier killed in Iraq. And I mean, they're all heroic, but in an incredibly self-sacrificing way. He challenged Donald Trump. He said, you've never gone to Arlington Seminary. You've never sacrificed. Also kind of challenged Trump's sense of who an American is. Let's listen.
Donald Trump, you're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
Greg, weigh in.
Just a very poignant moment. You know, I thought one of the things that he said that was so great is that when you go to Arlington, people of all faiths, nationalities, and ethnicities have fought and died for this country, and that, you know, trying to divide people by race or religion or what have you is not what the country's been about. It was about as eloquent speech as I heard all week, and the fact that this was a guy of the Muslim faith just made it all the more poignant. It was really a remarkable political moment.
Philly inspires music. Listen to Bruce Springsteen's Streets of Philadelphia while driving them. Or better yet, try the homegrown stuff.
We're going hopping today, where things are popping. The Philadelphia way, we're gonna drop it on all the music they play on the bandstand.
Ask people here, they go all the way back to Dick Clark's American Bandstand. Teens from across the country would crowd around relatively new black and white TVs and watch. Philly teens like Billy Cook became dancing household names. And of course, Philadelphia literally has the Philly sound. Teenagers singing on street corners became superstars like Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, the first act on the record label Philadelphia International. There was also Patti LaBelle, Chubby Checker, Jim Croce, Eve, Will Smith. We spoke with Dan Reed, music director and afternoon host at WXPN. He also works for the nationally syndicated show World Cafe. He was our guide to Philly sound, old and current, and we started by asking what he thinks of when he thinks of Philly music.
Well, I don't think there's any one sound. It's such a diverse city. I can tell you that to me, the intro was the great Philly sound of the 70s, the Gamble Huff stuff, the Philadelphia International label, all that great soul music that had, you know, amazing groove and sophistication, you know, with all the arrangements and the strings and the horns. I think that's the way a lot of people, at least of my age, came to know the sound of Philadelphia at this point.
You're talking about Gamble and Huff, who formed the label to compete with Detroit at the time. And here's one of the products, 1972, the OJ's The Love Train.
Don't you know that it's time to get on board and let this train keep on.
Dan Reed, the OJs originally from Ohio,
but
they are Philly soul or the Philly sound. So how did they become instrumental to Philadelphia's culture?
Well, I mean, I think that song right there, Love Train, you know, the thing about the Philly International label and so many of their hits, and I mentioned the sophistication, you know, the intimate arrangements that Gamble and Huff came up with, and Tom Bell to that degree as well, and others as well were involved in that. But the message behind that song, you know, Love Train, was such just a universal message. And, the OJs were from Ohio, but Gamble and Huff, I mean, they recorded all their stuff, their big hits here in Philly, mostly at the Sigma Sound Studios on North 12th Street between Vine and Race here in Philly.
And I'm thinking, too, 1972 was a convulsive year in the country with so much going on. President Nixon, Watergate, the winding down of the Vietnam War. So that song was great salve. But you mentioned diversity. And in the same year, 1972, you had Todd Rundgren, born in Upper Darby, not too far from where you're sitting, Philadelphia, got his start in the Philly group Woody's Truck Stop. Here's I Saw the Light.
So we walked alone, though I knew that there was something wrong, and a feeling that feels so strong about you. And you gazed up at me, and the answer was plain to see, 'cause I saw the light.
Dan Reed, same year, different sound.
Yeah, isn't that beautiful? Mm-hmm. I mean, what a genius he was. You know, that Something Anything album, which also featured Hello, It's Me, you know, that huge hit he had. Double record set, really the high water mark of his career, but he's done so many things. The pride of Upper Darby, home of Tina Fey and Jim Croce, too, went to Upper Darby High School, which is just a little west of the city here.
Well, we can't talk about Philadelphia without talking about Daryl Hall and John Oates. Met at the Adelphi Ballroom in Philly. Here's She's Gone off the album Abandoned Luncheonette.
She's gone. She's gone. Oh, I. Oh, I better learn how to face. She's gone. She's gone. Oh, I. Oh, I pay the devil to replace her. She's gone. And she's gone.
Now, Dan Reed, I got to tell you, you know, talking about the Philly sound, I want to go back to The Love I Lost by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes.
Oh, yeah.
And listen to these two songs back to back.
The love I lost.
She's Gone and The Love I Lost are the same song. I mean, this woke me up in the middle of the night the other night. I mean, what have Hall & Oates said about the Philly sound?
Well, you know, those guys, two white boys from Philly, yeah, they met. The story goes there was a gang fight in the ballroom, and they cowered in the stairwells and met there. During some sort of a battle of the bands in 1967. But, you know, it goes back to what I said earlier, that these producers and arrangers and singers weren't afraid to bring in more lush instrumentation to their music. And that's, you know, that's really that Philly sound of the 70s.
And Daryl Hall has said, no, I took that sound. I mean, he was trying do that.
Definitely.
We're going to skip over to 1995, The Roots with S.A. Woman at the Trocadero.
It's The Roots. Now what we want you all to do is sit back, y'all, and just relax, y'all.
Dan Reed, people know him now maybe as the backing band for Jimmy Fallon, but talk about The Roots.
Well, I mean, you know, they're ambassadors of hip-hop, I think. They're ambassadors for Philadelphia as well. I mean, Tariq, Black Thought, and Questlove have done a lot to raise the city's musical profile. And the Fallon show certainly brought them into mainstream attention. But, you know, these guys, they have a thing every year called the Roots Picnic. It's now expanded. They do one in New York as well, but started here in Philly. It's a day-long show, of course, plenty of hip-hop, but also rock, soul, world music. Amazing, amazing fun every year at the Roots Picnic.
Oh, so Sons of Philly there, the Roots. Next song, The War on Drugs. This is a 2014 song called Under the Pressure.
Wanna come down here?
Boy, you can hear the impact of Kurt Vile in there, that kind of dreaminess. This band founded in part with Kurt Vile, an artist I just love from Philadelphia.
He's a great guy.
Let's listen to a little Kurt Vile.
I'm living all the time, thanks, cause you're mine. You turn my dying days away. Each day we carry on like believers and lovers, though there are others who would rather run away.
So a little Kurt Vile there. Before that, a band he helped found, The War on Drugs. Just, you know, what impact have they had on the city? Tell us more about them.
I think their impact, I think their biggest impact's yet to come. I believe that Adam Grandisiel, War on Drugs guy, is going to write a song that's going to unite the rock spectrum here very soon. He's such a great guitar player. So you have, you know, guitar geeks out there watching him play, Neil Young fans, that sort of thing. And then alternative rock fans, college rock fans love the War on Drugs. He does it all, and that song there is just absolutely beautiful and poignant as well, I might add, Under the Pressure. That's from Lost in the Dream from 2014. He's got a new album coming out, too. I can't wait to hear.
So this is sort of Philly's future, even.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're all relatively young, and there's so many more bands out there in Philly right now that we discovered a few years ago. here at XPN that we were in the middle of an incredible renaissance of Philly music. And so we took it upon ourselves. We already played a lot of Philly music, but we play even more now because it's quality and, you know, it needs to be heard. But there's a lot more where that came from.
The Philly sound continues. Dan Reed, music director and afternoon host for WXPN in Philadelphia on a tour of that city's music history. Dan, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The music of Kurt Vile. And we'll have all the music from Philly and our Cleveland sounds as well at hearnow.org. But right now, we want to note one other Philly sound.
Turn me loose.
Oh, yeah, it's Fabian. The heartthrob discovered on a Philadelphia street corner, maybe one of the biggest stars in America in the 50s, early 60s. And in the 60s, guess who was president of the Fabian fan club? Of course, it was Hillary Clinton. It all ties together. It's Here and Now.
Turn me loose. Turn me loose, I'll sing. Gonna rock and roll, long as the band's gonna play. Gonna holler, gonna shout, gonna knock myself right out. So turn me loose.
Well, the Democratic National Convention is over, but moments from the DNC live on in perpetuity online. There was Susan Sarandon's frown, that crying Bernie bro in the Robin Hood hat. And yeah, it was a Robin Hood hat, not Peter Pan. And then there was this from President Obama.
And then there's Donald Trump. Don't boo. Vote.
Don't boo, vote. Well, here with a take on how that moment and others resonated in social media is Femi Okeh. She hosts The Stream on Al Jazeera English, and she's with us from Washington. Hi there.
Hi there, Megan. It was an oldie but goodie. So back in 2008, the then Senator Obama used that don't boo, vote phrase, and it got a similar reaction. And then when he was re-campaigning again in 2012, back in Las Vegas in August, almost 4 years ago to the week he said it in the DNC this week, again, he used that phrase, don't boo, vote.
Yeah, so an oldie but goodie. But of course, yeah. The difference between, I guess, 08 and now is that we have 8 years of social media, of development of social media. So what was the reaction online?
Well, it was the biggest DNC event online for Twitter up to that point in the DNC in Philly. And Google search, I just checked Google search, and they said there was a 190% spike in voter registration, how to vote in the U.S. That spiked by 190% after the president said, don't boo, vote.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so let's talk about another moment that got some considerable attention, especially on Twitter. This is from the moment where New Jersey Senator Cory Booker spoke about the importance of unity and love. And then he said this.
This is the understanding of love that's embodied in one of my favorite sayings. It's an African saying, and it says, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together.
Now, Femi, some very sharp-eared folks really picked up on a particular part of that.
You could always hear teeth being gritted across the internet. An African saying? Do you ever say a European saying? Or do you ever say a North American saying? So many countries in Africa. Twitter was not impressed.
Twitter was absolutely not impressed. I mean, so the online backlash inspired a piece in the magazine The Federalist about Democrats and identity politics, though. So what was
absolutely
the argument there?
Yeah, well, the breakdown was looking at the schisms that are in the Republican Party, but also the schisms that are in different groups amongst different groups in the Democratic Party, and how even though this was quite a contentious phrase, you know, if you'll go far if you go together, it absolutely is applicable to the Democratic Party right now and the work that they may have to do between now and November if they're actually going to actually win the next election.
Yeah.
So besides the Africa is not a country perspective, the idea that actually if we need to go together as Democrats, that was the argument that the Federalist was making.
So last couple of seconds quickly, Femi. Mm. I mean, how important is it that right now the conversation that happens online is as important, perhaps if not more important than the ones that people have in spaces like on the radio these days with these conventions?
I think it's critical right now. Can you not even hear in speeches? You can always guess. What is the line that they put in there for Twitter? What is the line they put in there for social social media. You can even buy, as from today, Don't Boo, Vote t-shirts. Huh. So the candidates know the power of social media and they're playing to it big time.
Femi Oke hosts the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
It's Here and Now from WRTI in Philly, which looked pretty good this week. Philly showed off its historical roots, Independence Hall, the Liberty Bell, and the convention highlighted that the city is booming. It's become a foodie capital. It's always been a center of music. But Philadelphia is also the largest city in the country with so-called deep poverty. How did that happen? Aaron Moselle of Here and Now contributor WHYY in Philadelphia reports.
In the middle of Westmoreland Street in North Philly is a red row home with steep stone steps. In the mid-1940s, Dolores Harris and her family lived here before moving around the corner and eventually out completely.
It was my grandmother, grandfather, and my great-grandmother and two aunts, and then my father, mother, and four kids.
Harris says the neighborhood was like one big family. They looked out for one another, even watched big boxing matches together.
Joe Louis was fighting, and everybody was on our steps and in our house, you know.
At that time, even those without a high school diploma could earn a good living. But things changed as 1960 crept closer. A lot of the factories that dotted the neighborhood were either declining or gone. Soon, there were fewer homeowners, more renters. The jobs simply weren't there to keep them around long.
You know, it's just like one drops off, and then another drops off, and then one day you look up and a lot of the people that I knew were not there.
Harris's story partially explains why Philadelphia is the poorest big city in the U.S., says Temple University professor Judith Levine. As factories packed up for bigger, cheaper spaces in the suburbs or overseas, neighborhoods started decaying.
And what's replaced it is this industry that requires not just some education, but a lot of education. So the healthcare industry and the higher education industry requires a lot of education. Our educational system is in disarray. It's underfunded. And our population is not highly educated.
So-called white flight did a lot of damage, too. It concentrated poverty in the city. Robert Chaskin teaches classes on urban poverty and social policy at the University of Chicago. He says some of that phenomenon was fueled by the real estate industry. As more and more African Americans moved from the rural South to northern cities, including Philly, realtors used scare tactics to drive out white working class families.
Making the case that this neighborhood is about to change, you know, Black people are going to move in, your property values are going to go down, you should get out while you can. And so they were able to, particularly in these sort of work-class homeowner neighborhoods, sort of purchase these properties at relatively low prices and then turn around and rent them, often breaking them into smaller units at premiums to the African-Americans who were moving in.
At the same time, banks made it difficult or impossible for African Americans living in certain areas to get loans, mortgages, and other financial services. Redlining was officially outlawed in the 1970s, but its impact is still being felt today, says Chaskin. Which brings us to 2016. Roughly one quarter of Philadelphians live in poverty, and roughly half of them are living in what's called deep poverty. That means earning less than half of the federal poverty line. For a single parent with two children, we're talking about roughly $10,000 a year. These figures are bad, but just a few years ago, they were actually worse. During the height of the Great Recession, Philadelphia's poverty rate was 28%. But since then, Temple professor Judith Levine says the city's population has grown steadily every year. And the people moving in, a lot of them aren't living in poverty. Many are young professionals.
They are diluting the poverty rate because they're part of the denominator of the population of the city, and they're not part of the numerator of people in poverty.
In other words, Philadelphia still has roughly the same number of people living in poverty. Levine sees some silver linings. She's encouraged by the city's new mayor, Jim Kenney, and his commitment to addressing poverty. But Levine thinks the city will be dealing with the same issues 10, even 20 years from now, in part because it can take multiple generations to break the cycle of poverty, and there's not enough being done to shrink it. Back in North Philly, Dolores Harris heads towards her car to return to her new home. She lives in Chestnut Hill now, one of the city's wealthiest neighborhoods. Talking to her, you get the sense there's a twinge of guilt that she left Westmoreland Street behind, and that others have too.
We keep running. Where are we running to? You know, what's going to be the ultimate? Because at some point, we're not going to be able to run anymore, you know. If we have a problem here, did anybody stop to think about, let's fix this problem, and then maybe we won't have to run?
But what Harris calls running often gets called moving up. And one of Philadelphia's biggest challenges is to help people out of poverty while also working to ensure longtime residents in gentrifying neighborhoods don't get pushed out so people can move up without feeling they have to move out. For Here and Now, I'm Aaron Mozell in Philadelphia.
Well, let's turn now to Florida, where Governor Rick Scott made an announcement today that, in a way, many have been expecting for months.
Four people in our state likely have the Zika virus as a result of a mosquito bite. This means Florida has become the first state in our nation to have local transmission of the Zika virus.
Florida already has nearly 400 cases of Zika. Those cases, however, were all contracted through travel or sexual transmission. Health officials in Florida say that even with these new mosquito-transmitted Zika cases, they are confident that they can contain the disease. So joining us now with more from Miami is NPR correspondent Greg Allen. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Megna.
So first of all, tell us what more do we know about these four locally transmitted cases?
Well, they've been looking at these cases for a couple of weeks now, testing mosquitoes in the area and residents in the area. And they've decided that it's an area that's about 1 square mile just north of downtown in Miami. It's an area called the Wynwood Arch District. This is an area that's kind of been in resurgence in the last several years. It's very popular with tourists and visitors from all around the world. So we have a lot of people who visit there who come from places that maybe where you have a lot of Zika already out in the population. So although in the 2 weeks of testing, they haven't found any mosquitoes in the area. They trap them and then test them. They haven't found any that test positive for Zika, but they've determined that this is, in fact, the first cases of local transmitted Zika in the U.S.
Because all the other means of transmission didn't apply in these cases. Okay.
That's right.
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier that health officials say that they're optimistic that they can contain Zika. I mean, with these locally transmitted, perhaps mosquito-borne cases, how can they really be sure of that?
Well, it's one hopes they're sure. This is a state, as you would understand, that they take mosquito control very seriously. Every county has a very strong mosquito control program. So first, you take that, first of all. And also, we've had some experience with mosquito-borne diseases here. We've had an outbreak of dengue fever here. Dengue, a couple of different outbreaks in Key West and then other smaller outbreaks in other parts of the state that they've controlled fairly quickly. Also, more recently, outbreaks of at least local transmitted cases of chikungunya, another mosquito-borne disease transmitted by the same mosquito. And the state has done a fairly good job at controlling that and knocking those back. So we don't really see dengue here, one or two cases a year now, even though it's been out there locally. They think they can do the same thing with Zika, and they're spending a lot of money on it. Governor Scott has got $20 million of state money. President Obama just sent $5 million more. So they're doing this testing and surveillance in the areas, and they're going door-to-door with handheld insecticide sprayers, spraying for mosquitoes and talking to people about the need to use repellent and to get rid of all the standing water in their around their houses.
Huh. So obviously, this is a very large concern, and you know, ever more so for pregnant women in Miami and Florida now, right?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, for your typical healthy person who's not childbearing years, Zika, you know, it's the disease is not that stressful. I mean, very rarely do you have anybody hospitalized. Very even more rare do you have deaths from it. But if you are of childbearing years, you have a spouse who could become pregnant, then it's something you have to be concerned about. So that's going to have a lot of people here in Miami concerned of people in those years. Zika has been linked with birth defects, including microcephaly, in other places. We've got one case here in Florida, a travel-related case of a baby that was born with microcephaly, and that was someone who was traveling abroad. So we're starting to see it in this country. The concern is that if it went further, that it could be a real problem for pregnant women here. Our Surgeon General in Florida says, though, that she thinks the risk has not gone up for pregnant women as long as they take precautions, wear repellent, and take steps to protect their homes from mosquitoes, that they should be okay.
And, Greg, in the last couple seconds that we have, I mean, now that we have locally transmitted cases in Florida, certainly there's a concern that it could move even further across the United States.
Well, it has to do with this one species of mosquito, the Aedes aegypti. They are found mostly on the Gulf Coast area, but they do go up the East Coast and also in the Southwest and Southern California. So we have it there. And they're mosquitoes that like to spend time near people's homes. They like to go indoors. But you just have to drain and cover. Make sure you protect yourself.
NPR's Greg Allen in Miami. Greg, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
It's Here and Now.
No rebuilding project here in Philadelphia is getting more attention than the Divine Lorraine Hotel. The 1890s late Victorian high-rise was long owned by the beloved Father Divine, an African-American spiritual leader and peace activist whose flock lived in the hotel. It became the city's first racially integrated hotel. For the last 15 years, though, the building became as blighted as the neighborhood around it. It was abandoned. It collected trash and graffiti. But now it's covered with scaffolding.
You know, there's such a mystique. I've been doing this my whole career, and I've never seen anything like the Divine Lorraine.
That's developer Eric Blumenfeld, who bought the building in 2012 and with private and public money is leading a $44 million restoration. We met up with the Lorraine and asked, why is this hotel so important?
You know, this building was teetering on demolition for about a decade, and to me, it was kind of representative of what this city is going to do. It's like we were at a crossroad, and if we could not salvage such a beautiful piece of history and architecture, that it made a poor statement on the future of Philadelphia.
There seems to us to be some irony that this was an interracial hotel at one time, and now this is becoming a more gentrified interracial neighborhood. But there are some dissenters, people who worry that the rents are going up, they can't afford to live here anymore, that this is going to become a completely white neighborhood, which is just the opposite of what this hotel once stood for.
Yeah, well, Robin, I have an issue with the word gentrified because, to me, it means that somebody's getting kicked out. And I don't think that that's anything of what we're doing. I think, really, our world is about bringing different cultures and different communities together. And the Divine Lorraine is not really just one project. It's a project of this entire corridor. So if you look around, you know, 10 years ago, this was a godforsaken stretch of Philadelphia. And
how about here at the Divine Lorraine? Are there going to be affordable housing units in here? What are you going to put in here?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We did not have an affordable component.
You weren't required to, either.
Required to, but, you know, as a practical matter, we're going to have people of all walks of life. And there's so many different components to this community because we have restaurants planned, we have a cafe planned. There actually was an original speakeasy right over here. And there was a secret entrance off of Broad Street, and so we're recreating that. And there was a subway entrance that goes right into the hotel. And so when you think about the level of employment opportunities...
Let's just be a little more pointed. You're going to have rental units. What are you going to rent them for?
$1,400. Actually, $1,350. And then they go as high as $3,000 for, like, these glorious penthouse bi-level units.
That's actually not that bad for a big city. And Eric says people will also be living in a museum. As we enter past the guard, we see why. Strung lights reveal the building's beautiful bones. Even with the just terrible decay, look at this glorious building.
Does it give you chills on the back of your neck?
Chills.
That's what it does to me.
There's beautiful molding all around the ceiling, columns down the hall. What a grand entranceway. It must have been graffiti, too, all over it now.
Right, and actually one of the local art groups asked if we could preserve the graffiti. And I said, I love you, but no. So we've actually removed all the graffiti on the exterior, and it's going to be phenomenal because... This is the original floor. The walls are pretty much original.
The Lorraine is mostly unfinished, but we went up to see a sample apartment.
700-square-foot one-bedroom.
You've left exposed brick.
And there are two balconies. The windows actually mimic the exact original windows down to the profile and the color. The cornice, I mean, we've painstakingly preserved the exterior of this entire building.
We also went to the basement to see the old entrance to the Prohibition-era speakeasy. The Divine Lorraine is scheduled to open later this year, and Philadelphians are already buying swag, sneakers, and coffee mugs. But for Eric, there's one person he most wants to impress, the Divine Lorraine's late great owner.
I have these dreams that Father Divine walks in the day of opening, and he says, "Nice job, Eric."
Eric Blumenfeld of the Divine Lorraine will have terrific pictures at hereandnow.org. Our souvenirs from this great city. Thanks to our new friends at WRTI, Joe Patti and Ray Devine, to our WBUR DNC engineers, George Hicks, Doug Wilson, Dave DeRozier, and Lord of the Patch Cable, Carl Voker. Thank you to the crew back in Boston, especially you, Ethan, and you know why. On the road, Alex Ashlock, Samantha Fields, Dean Russell, and Peter, I'll Sleep When I Die, O'Dowd. Thank you, superstar technical directors James Trout and Paul Vikas. And to our listeners, how great to meet you on the road. Thank you so much for your hospitality. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.